Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Craig's latest Florida Phoenix column picks up with one of a number of dastardly bills signed into law by Ron DeSantis in this last legislative session. The one you picked up on has not been receiving as much attention as some of the others. So why zero in on this one?
Well, it just seemed like the sort of the last straw, and there was a lot of attention given to what they're calling the sprawl bill, which means that if some citizen sues to block a change in their zoning or land use referendums, land use that's designed to benefit a developer, they could wind up footing the bill for the developer once he intervenes. And it's designed to discourage people from filing legal challenges.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But what was, to me, even more, and to use your word, dastardly, was this bill to say citizen-led referendums on land use changes are no longer allowed. You can't do that anymore at all. And those don't happen very often, but when they occur, they're pretty big. And they're used as a nuclear deterrent on some changes. And I gave the specific example from Venice, where Venice passed a 600-page change in its land use regulations that made developers happy and made a lot of people very angry. And so five people in Venice formed this group called Venice United, and started a petition drive to have a referendum to repeal all of those land use changes. And the city council got really nervous, and that's what it took to get their attention. Mm-hmm. And so they worked out a deal. They worked out a compromise to repeal what needed to be repealed. And they didn't have to have the referendum. But if they didn't have that threat there, they wouldn't have had any negotiations at all. And yeah. Now citizens can't do that.
I think, well, just forget the development growth thing. The idea of taking away the rights of citizens to essentially petition their government for a redress of grievances. I recall that phrase from somewhere. I'm not sure where it was. Maybe the Miami Herald or something.
Something you read on July 4th, no doubt.
Somewhere, yeah. But I mean, again, this is another attempt of many by this legislature and this governor to take away rights from local municipalities, but also local citizens, and put it in state hands. But I think it's also incredibly telling where this idea and from whom this bill was hatched.
Oh, yeah. It was originally sponsored by the senior vice president for government affairs of the Miami Realtors Association, which I said that that's about as close to the development industry as Darth Vader was to Emperor Palpatine.
Great line. The largest realtor group in the country.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't want citizens to have any say in what the developers do. So they're trying to block off every possible avenue.
Because citizens tend to want to reel back development, and developers obviously want the opposite. And this,
People want to save what they think of as precious for their community, what it is that brought them there. Mm-hmm. Developers just want to make a profit, and they're not necessarily into saving what's precious. And so there's going to be conflicts. And now the legislature hasn't just put a thumb on the scale for the development side. They put both hands and both feet on the scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This bill, the sprawl bill, as you mentioned, radioactive roads got signed into law. We talked about that numerous times, using phosphorus mining waste, radioactive piezo gypsum in road construction, something that's outlawed by the Environmental Protection Agency. But we're going to try that in Florida because it's a great idea, according to Ron DeSantis and the legislature. And he also vetoed a bipartisan measure increasing electric vehicles in the state fleet, which is pure madness.
Yeah, well, I mean, but he's been saying lots and lots of good things about the fossil fuels industry for several years because they make big campaign donations.
And absolutely.
He needs those to run for president.
Right. So. And he also signed the pro-fertilizer anti-clean water bill. So all of the worst environmental bills to get out of the legislature were signed into law by Ron DeSantis. And obviously, here's an individual who has no concern whatsoever for the environment, for open spaces, for green spaces, for the wildlife, plants, animals, that sort of thing. But you hit the nail on the head. Phosphorus mining, the fertilizer industry, developers, real estate, fossil fuels. What do all those people have? A ton of money. What does Ron DeSantis need? A ton of money, because he's launched a failing presidential campaign and is going to need hundreds of millions of dollars in advertisements to make up for his utter lack of charisma when he's in a competition against a field of people who have all of their faults, but the front runner has a lot of charisma in the minds of the people who DeSantis is trying to win votes from.
Yeah, he was an actual TV star. And to a lot of people, that's all that counts.
Yeah.
Regardless of indictments and so forth. Yeah.
FloridaPhoenix.com. I want to give a couple of recommendations along with Craig's column each week at the FloridaPhoenix.com. Another great podcast. If you enjoy this, there is a podcast series just released from iHeartMedia, which is one of the largest media companies in the world, called Big Sugar. And it is an investigative report into specifically the working conditions on the sugar plantations south of Lake Okeechobee. It will curl your toes. It is exceptional. Big Sugar, wherever you find your podcast, give that a search. Also, Amazon Prime has a fantastic documentary I ran across called Invisible History, Middle Florida's Hidden Roots. And this is all about the Tallahassee's incorporation and forming of the capital, and well, the city, and then the capital there and its connection to slavery through the present day. I found that to be a fascinating documentary on Amazon Prime. I'll put links to both of those in the show notes if you'd like to do some reading outside of class.
Speaking of reading, sure. I have a question. The one on sugar, that's based on Alec Wilkinson's book, if I remember right.
You know, I know we did our Big Sugar episode. I'm not sure if this is related to his book or not. I should know that, but I don't. Want to thank Windstorm Products, as always, for sponsoring the podcast. It is hurricane season. So Windstorm Products, windstormproducts.com, they're the folks who can help you secure your home from all that hurricane wind damage, the shutters and the patio furniture and everything you're worried about flying around and going through your windows in hurricane. They will help you secure that stuff. They got the bolts and everything that you need to secure your home from hurricane wind damage. Windstormproducts.com. Also want to thank all of our patrons at Patreon.com. Patreon.com/welcome to Florida. Craig, we owe our patrons another bonus episode. So in the next week or two, we need to get on and record another bonus episode for all the folks there. We're up, I don't know, 25, 30 patrons, and for as little as $5 a month, folks can support our production of the podcast there. All right. This week's episode, Craig mentioned nuclear bombs in his Florida Phoenix column. Well, these during the Cuban Missile Crisis were not metaphorical. We were talking about actual nuclear bombs and the threat of nuclear war, which centered right off the coast of Florida. What is this, 60 years ago or so now?
Michael Tagias is an author of multiple books, I think 30 or 40 books, but there are two in particular that caught my attention. He's a speaker through the Florida Humanities Council, and he has written about the Cuban Missile Crisis and has interviewed people about its effects, not just on the whole world, but on Florida in particular. And so I thought this is a great topic for us to talk about. So.
The book is Above and Beyond: John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission. It is a global story. It is also a Florida story. And Michael Tagias joins us on this episode.
Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. What first attracted you to the subject of the Cuban Missile Crisis?
It was coming across that untold story angle. There are four lesser known stories, one of which is the Russians did shoot down and kill one of our pilots during the crisis. And I had no idea that happened, so I figured most readers are not aware of that either.
kind of set it up for us. This happened in, what was it, October of 62 when the crisis first began?
Yes. And so we discovered the missiles in Cuba by overflights with our U-2 spy planes. Mm-hmm. And of course, the U.S. was caught off guard by the surprise that lo and behold, the Russians had established medium range ballistic missiles there. As the U-2 flights continued during the 13 days of the crisis, I opened Above and Beyond with one pilot who narrowly escaped with his life. You know, they're flying 13 miles above the earth, mm-hmm. beyond where any MiGs could reach, but surface-to-air missiles could reach them. And that was an unknown story, that he narrowly escaped with his life. But then the pilot who flew after him was not as lucky. Mm-hmm. And his name was Major Rudy Anderson.
But now, where were the flights taken off from?
What we know as Orlando Airport, but the McCoy Airport there. And we had moved in, the U.S. had moved in our top 11 U-2 pilots there to do continuous overflights once the missiles were discovered, because we were potentially going to do a D-Day style invasion.
Continuous as in they were flying over all the time, flying constantly?
No, not all the time, because they were dependent on clear weather. The technology at the time could not penetrate cloud cover. So whenever there was clear weather, we would launch a plane from Orlando. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell people what a U-2 plane was, what it looked like? I'm not sure they... nowadays, we know U-2 is a band, you know?
Exactly. A single-seater. And I describe it as a glider on steroids. So, you know, they're very lightweight, actually pretty fragile, but they've got this jet engine that can take it up to 13 miles above the earth. And then they're at this cruising altitude and with these sophisticated cameras can get pictures. So there's no weapons on board. There's no bombs. There's no, you're a sitting duck, basically, when you're in a U-2 against a surface-to-air missile.
Wow.
The Cuban Missile Crisis obviously was one of the major international global news stories of the 20th century. You mentioned a little bit about how it was a Florida story because the U-2 planes were taking off from the Orlando area. How else was this a Florida story in addition to a global story?
Well, the U.S. had poured in all our military resources into Florida. I've interviewed people that lived through that time, and they said they saw trucks and trucks of troops coming down, you name it. And then over in Key West, that's where we had most of our fighter jets. There was one meeting with Kennedy, and he goes, can I see the pictures of the, you know, layout of the fighter jets? And he goes, they're way too close together. One surprise attack by the Russians going to take out several of these jets. We need to disperse them to even places like the West Palm Beach Airport.
Wow. And then Homestead Air Force Base, too, was on war exactly. footing at that point. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, another reason I did Above and Beyond is Kennedy secretly audio recorded every meeting he had on the Cuban Missile Crisis. So those audio tapes have survived. And it's like you have an inside seat into these leaders deciding the fate of the world.
Wow.
At the White House cabinet.
And all, if I remember, all the military leaders wanted to invade. They just said, oh, well, we can't let those missiles stay there. We have to immediately launch an attack, right?
Absolutely. They said, we need this element of surprise. The Russians don't know that we've discovered the missiles. And in the first 2 days, Kennedy was agreeing with them. But you see his thought process evolve, where he starts to say, well, don't you think the Russians will respond? Don't you think this could lead to nuclear war and millions of innocents be killed? And the military was still pressing for that surprise attack.
Was it General Curtis LeMay that was pushing the hardest? That's certainly his reputation anyway.
Absolutely. He was borderline insubordinate at the meetings.
Dang.
And behind Kennedy's back, he was calling him a chicken. And to his face, he would go, you're looking pretty weak. this is worse than the appeasement at Munich. And he actually ran for vice president with George Wallace later. That would have been quite a ticket, huh?
You mentioned talking to Florida residents who remember seeing all of the troop transports coming in and all of the activity. The fear, obviously, and we'll go back in time a little bit. The United States always had, you know, it was Fortress America with two oceans on either side. This was before, you know, submarine-based missiles or missiles from anywhere in the world could strike anywhere else in the world. So the idea that these missiles were in Cuba, 90 miles from Key West and mainland United States, that put the fear of God in people, because these missiles could then reach DC, they could reach New York, they could reach Chicago. And if the Soviets wanted to just do a punitive, preemptive attack, you know, they weren't firing missiles from the Eastern Bloc that would plop down in the Atlantic Ocean. They could reach terra firma, United States. So Florida especially was sensitive to that because it's so close. So it try and take us back into the mind of residents living in Florida in this time, and in what probably would not be an overestimation to describe as hysteria.
Yeah, hysteria, but no widespread panic. Like, there was no looting of stores or that, but there was, like, for example, one woman said, as soon as Kennedy addressed the nation, my father started digging in the backyard to build a shelter.
Dang. Wow.
And, you know, you mentioned the tie to Florida. My ace in the hole for writing the book was Brigadier General Jerry McElmoyle from Venice, Florida. He was the pilot back at the time, was a lieutenant in the Air Force, who was shot at and narrowly missed. So I worked hand in hand with him through that book. And that's how I actually met Craig, was through the Florida Humanities, when they said this would be a perfect program that the humanities would support.
Yeah.
It was because of Jerry's help every step of the way. So I spent a lot of time in Venice with Jerry.
What was it like for them to fly those flights? I mean, knowing they couldn't shoot back or anything like that.
He would describe it as beautiful. You could see the curvature of the earth. It only took 40 minutes to get over the lush island of Cuba. But he said, when I could see that, he called it a telephone pole, the contrails from the surface, the air missile coming at them, everything changed.
Yeah, it wasn't so beautiful anymore.
I remember saying my first meeting, so what did you do? You're seeing the contrails. He goes, I did what I'm trained to do, and that's bank the plane and take photos of it. I knew it was off course. It wasn't going to strike me, and I wanted proof that they're now firing us.
Spoiler alert, everything turned out okay, I guess. You know, for the most part, give us the Cliff Notes version on how Kennedy's patience and diplomacy was able to win the day over the more hawkish generals.
You know, a lot of things had to go just right, and they did. There were four incidents that people don't know about that had us a whisker away from nuclear war. And luckily, Khrushchev's outlook was similar to Kennedy's. He was not out to destroy the world. And I had a long conversation with Khrushchev's son, who remembers talking to his father in depth during this crisis. And his father's worry was the same as Kennedy's. This thing is going to spiral out of control because of some screw-ups.
How did they communicate back and forth? Because there wasn't a hotline in the White House at the point.
No, it was cables, and the hotline was a result of the crisis.
That's amazing. So they just would cable back and forth?
Yes.
Directly from each other? Wow. I had read something, I don't know if this is accurate, where Khrushchev sent one message saying, we can work this out, and then later sent another message saying that was much more belligerent, and Kennedy had to decide which one to respond to.
Yes, but it was Bobby Kennedy who came up with the idea of, let's ignore the belligerent one, pretend we, you know, never got it. An answer to the one that makes a little more sense.
It went to the spam folder.
Well, and again, you have to remember, and all of a sudden it's not so hard anymore, the brinksmanship and the posturing that was required. You know, this was us versus them, East versus West, capitalism versus communism, freedom versus communism. So as you mentioned from the generals, even the perception of, let's just pump the brakes a little bit. Oh, you're weak. Where's your right. spine?
Well, and, exactly. and also just to put it in context, this was after the Bay of Pigs embarrassment, right?
Yes. And thank God Kennedy learned from that. He made a number of mistakes, but at least he learned from the mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, his biggest gaffe and his greatest triumph, I think, on the global stage, without question, are those two incidents related to Cuba. And then, you know, this all winds down. So then everyone pulls back out of Florida, and it's business as usual after that, for the most part.
Yes, again, but for that death of Major Anderson, was blown out of the sky.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that. How did that happen?
He was the last pilot to make the run over Cuba. And we know two things. One, he never got off a Mayday. He never tried to eject, because I have a photo of his plane in pieces on the ground, and he was still in the cockpit.
Wow.
You know, so it was an interesting, I've done 30 books for adults. This was the toughest one I ever tackled, not because the information was so difficult to get. There was so much information. And I like to make my books very fast paced for the general public. So the decision was tough of what to leave out to keep mm-hmm. that pace going.
Did he even get any shots of the missiles before he was shot down?
We don't know, but it looks like what happened was, and Jerry explained this to me, he said, Mike, just one piece of shrapnel could bring down a U-2. And he said, I think this spiraled down from the sky 13 miles like a leaf spiraling from a tree. First one wing comes off, then the other, and on the ground was just the fuselage and the cockpit together.
Wow.
Put yourself in the mind of the pilot. You know, he knows he's going down. That's a long ride, brother, to, you know, think about the ever after.
He would have died instantaneously.
Oh, did he?
Almost, okay. Though, because of the lack of air pressure in the cockpit.
Oh, okay.
Because there was a piece of shrapnel that went through his pressurized suit that he was wearing. So we were pretty sure it was very quick, thank God.
Where did the wreckage land?
Near Banyes, Cuba, which would be the eastern part of the island.
Did that play into the negotiations at all? The fact that A, they knew we were taking pictures, but B, that they shot down one of our planes?
You know, not directly, but I think indirectly, according to Sergei, Khrushchev's son, Khrushchev realized, okay, it is spiraling out of control. I didn't even give authorization for them to shoot down this U-2. And they, you know, our guys on the ground did it on their own. So he recognized it's almost out of control.
And he was trying to get the U.S. to remove missiles from Turkey, if I remember right.
Well, that was part of the secret agreement. But he was trying to just basically, if you put yourself in the Russian shoes, level the playing field and put missiles on our doorstep like we had over in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kennedy responded with it wasn't a blockade. What was his term for the having the ships surround the island?
It was a blockade, but he called it a quarantine for legal reasons. And so that bought him more time. I thought it was a brilliant first step. And everybody said it'll never work. And he said, you're probably right, but at least it gives me more options.
Yeah.
And that's a sign of a good decision. Leave yourself some options.
Yeah. And stay calm. They were intercepting. They weren't intercepting all ships, right? Just the ones carrying supplies for the missiles.
That they thought would be military.
So they were still bringing in supplies, food and things like that, but not anything for them.
As far as I remember correctly, yeah, they were zeroed in on the ones that they suspected would be bringing in weapons.
Where did the ships from our fleet come from? Were they based in Florida also, or were they from all over?
All over. I interviewed somebody who was at Guantanamo Bay, and he said, Mike, you could look out from Guantanamo, and it was ship after ship after ship. That whole island was encircled.
Wow.
You mentioned writing 30 books for adults and more for children. The latest of those is called Extreme Survival: Lessons from Those Who Have Triumphed Against All Odds. you know, you do write history books, but a lot of your books focus on shipwrecks, disasters at sea, a famous one, The Finest Hours, which was turned into a Disney movie. So you've got this interest in, you know, extreme survival and wrecks, and when all goes wrong, how to pull out of those situations. Tell us a little bit about the new book and some of these lessons of survival.
After 35 years of interviewing probably 100 different survivors who shouldn't be on the planet, I said, you know, I'd be foolish not to, one, incorporate some of those lessons into my own life when I'm faced with adversity, day-to-day adversity. I don't, because they taught me some little techniques. But then I said, this could be an interesting book if I group some of the survival stories by the technique they used to keep fighting on. So, for example, chapter one is The Power of Little Steps. Chapter two is Thinking of Others. For example, there's the big Florida connection with that book is Locke Reedy, who lives in Florida. He survived 3 days adrift at sea. And he said, when I was about to give up, I thought of my 14-year-old daughter and how much she needed me. And that gave me the strength to fight for a couple more hours. And so I, you know, he goes into chapter two where people use something from beyond themselves to power through the toughest periods of their life. So it's a mix of people who I interviewed, who I said I could have never survived that, and people from history. For example, John McCain, 7 years as a POW. How did he get through that without cracking up?
You obviously have a fascination with the ocean and the might of the ocean and this sense of man versus nature, but specifically man versus the ocean. Where does that come from?
My personal love of the sea, number one, but oftentimes I find that the best survival stories do involve the ocean.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, in extreme survival, I didn't want to put in one or 2 hour ordeals. I want it to be multi-day ordeals. And those tended to happen either on distant mountaintops or in the ocean. So there's a mix of stories. It could be people lost in the woods, but the ocean plays a big role, as it has in many of my books.
Yeah, I think that's a universal feeling of humanity, you know, the scale of the ocean, the how intimidating it feels when you're in the ocean and you can not see land in any direction, how foreign that feels for humans to not have, you know, firm ground to stand on, you know, all of the, you know, and again, the tales of the, go back to Moby Dick, Robinson Crusoe. I mean, as long as there's been literature, there are mermaids and sea monsters and all of this sort of thing, that the mystery and the mystique and the magic of the ocean, and we obviously, you know, experience that in Florida, that's universal to mankind.
Yeah, Chad, you hit the nail on the head, you know, and that feeling that you're so insignificant out there. So imagine poor Locke Reedy out there. You're like a grain of sand on a beach. You're just insignificant. You're 300 miles from land. Nobody really knows exactly where you are. Yeah. His friend and his captain had died in his arms in the ocean, and Locke vowed, I will not let you go. I'll bring you home. And now, again, that actually turned out to be one of the reasons he kept fighting. He thought, I need to live to bring my friend's body home so they know what happened to him.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. Are you working on another book at this point?
I hop around. I did a couple books for young adults that actually are doing better for adults. More adults are buying them than kids. And they're about lesser known World War II stories. One is called Abandoned Ship, and it's about a British passenger liner as big as the Titanic that was sunk during World War II by a U-boat. And the U-boat captain, 3,000 people in the water, he hears cries for help in Italian, and he realized, oh my God, there must have been Italian POWs on board the ship I just sank. I need to start saving them. So he starts saving everybody he can and calls in more U-boats for help. And it just is the oddest story I came across in all of World War II.
Wow.
And it gets a lot stranger, the story. And then the second half of the book is, of those thousands of people, only a handful survived. How did they survive? So I was able to actually use one of those stories in the book, Extreme Survival, because he was in a lifeboat of 55 people and only four made it. How did this one individual make it when nobody else did? And although I didn't interview them, he wrote a firsthand account of what it was like in the lifeboat and what gave him the strength to keep fighting when others gave up and drank seawater.
Yeah, those stories are amazing. You know, it's the sun and the dehydration and the, you know, your skin is baking off your body typically in these situations, or the cold, you know, pick your poison. Night. Would you rather be in the North Atlantic and freeze to death, or would you rather be in the South Seas with the, you know, the sun literally, you know, frying the skin off your bones? But the, you know, anyone who's ever really been thirsty, and most people have never in their lives really been thirsty, right, but if you have, for whatever reason, gone 12, 14 hours without a drink, a couple of days, you know, I mean, like wrestlers who've had to cut weight. I mean, there are very few circumstances when people have ever had to purposefully deprive themselves and get close to that 3-day threshold of which you can live without water. Hunger is a walk in the park compared to being thirsty. I think most people agree.
And you're surrounded by water in these life rafts.
There so it is. Yep.
Oh, I found that the survivors who often made it were the ones early on who just made a vow to themselves, I'm going to go down fighting. I may not make it. You know, it wasn't always positive thoughts. And I remember one of them who I became very close to said, I thought to myself, I may not make it, but I'm going to go down fighting. And he made it. Yeah, 3 days. He was in the North Atlantic in the middle of November.
Wow. I had one more Cuban Missile Crisis related question to ask you.
Yes.
Has there ever been another incident like that where we were that close to World War III, or is that as close as we've ever come?
It definitely is as close as we've ever come, again, because of four lesser known incidents. One involves a U-2 plane that strayed over Russian airspace in Siberia. At the height of the crisis.
Oh, my Lord.
Imagine that. Yeah. He was lost to the Aurora Borealis. The Northern Lights messed him all up because he was using celestial navigation. And he strays all the way into Russian airspace. So they think maybe the Americans are attacking the motherland. They did scramble MiGs. They didn't know it was a U-2. They just knew it was some, you know, aircraft coming into their airspace. And it was a tense situation. Wow. I mean, he wrote a firsthand account as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What were the other three incidents? The two U-2s, right?
Yep. One involves the Russian sub that had, quote, a special torpedo on board. And we had said, we're going to drop practice depth charges. If we find your sub, that means you've got to surface and move away. Well, he thinks they're real depth charges. And he says, we're all going to die, but we're going to take them with us. Load the special torpedo.
Oh, my Lord.
And I don't want to give away the other one because then nobody will read the books.
Above and Beyond, John F. Kennedy and America's Most Dangerous Cold War Spy Mission is the Cuban Missile Crisis book, the most recent book from Michael Tugayas, Extreme Survival, Lessons from Those Who Have Triumphed Against All Odds. I'll put a link to Michael's website in the show notes. You can see all of the books down there. Again, if you are fascinated with shipwrecks and stories of survival at sea, Michael has one or more books that will be right up your alley. Thank you so much for joining us today, Michael.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chad, and thank you, Craig. It was a pleasure.
Craig, when you were in grade school, were schools still doing the duck and cover atomic bomb testing drills?
No, but we did have. I have two stories about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I was too young. I'm too young to remember.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But two things. One is a friend of mine, William McKean, who was a University of Florida journalism professor for a long time. He was at Homestead Air Force Base as a child during the Cuban Missile Crisis and remembers very vividly how everybody kind of went into overdrive there. But he was particularly resentful of it because it happened at Halloween. And and the the commander of the base decreed that that trick-or-treating could only take 30 minutes. You were only allowed to be out of your house for 30 minutes trick-or-treating.
Mad dash.
I know. And so all the kids were, they were running around like crazy, ringing the doorbells, trick-or-treat, trick-or-treat, trick-or-treat. And he never forgot that. And he was very mad about that for a long time as a kid. The other thing that resulted was that Florida legislators were so concerned about having, you know, these evil communists on virtually on our doorstep that they began requiring that every high school senior in Florida had to take a class called Americanism versus Communism. And they passed this in the mid 60s. They were still doing it when I was a high school senior in 1978. And they continued for another 3 or 4 years after that, where for about 6 months, about half a school year, we had a class on what we call it AVC, and our textbooks were J. Edgar Hoover's Masters of Deceit, which is
yikes.
All the minus, and the other book was Animal Farm by George Orwell. I learned that George Orwell is a much better writer than J. Edgar Hoover. And went on to read several other George Orwell books. But the other thing, too, is, you know, there's all this talk these days about indoctrinating kids. And I think back to that time of how many of those kids went on to move to some place that where there are socialist and communist principles at work and the way the government runs. And they're like, oh, yeah, I remember this.
Americanism is an interesting term.
Yeah.
Loaded in any number of respects. But that was the era. You know, I am old enough to be a child of the Cold War. You know, I distinctly remember a lot of the Reagan braggadocio, the airstrikes in Libya, the Berlin Wall coming down, you know, that whole the tension that existed that had not been there for a long time. You know, Vladimir Putin is trying to revive a lot of that. But, you know, I think for millennials, for Gen Zers, that Cold War, that Russia versus U.S., Soviet U.S., communism, capitalism thing is kind of opaque, but you know, for you and me and our parents, certainly, I mean, that's as real as it gets.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, it led to lots of spending on military forces in Florida. So
it certainly did. Yeah. Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.